Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this wonderful gathering as we listen to Rabbi Harold Kushner share wisdom for all of us. I bring warm greetings from Father Michael O'Connell, who's unable to be here this evening because he, a year and a half ago, had arranged to speak for a friend of his 40th ordination gathering and wasn't able to get out of that. So I bring Father O'Connell's greetings to you from the Basilica as well, welcoming you to this beautiful place. This evening, we have a very special opportunity, not only to hear one of the great wise men of our world, but also to have an interaction with him and be able to ask some questions at the conclusion of his speech. The ushers will have small cards that they're going to be handing out to you during the speech. And if you have a question, if you simply write your question on that card, they will be gathered when he's completed, and then we will be able to ask those questions. We will not ask questions from the floor. We will ask questions simply from these cards. So please take note of that. Also, there will be a book sale outside following this evening. On your right, you will see books that Harold Kushner will be signing for you personally. On your left will be books that were already signed by him. So if you would like to have a book signed and not have it personalized, they're two different tables. So please make note of that. This evening, we have a number of people to thank for this event. First of all, for the Basilica of St. Mary for making this evening possible. We thank them for allowing this beautiful space to be used for such a wonderful gathering. We thank the Bookcase of Wayzata, and especially Peggy Burnett, for helping put this together and for running the book sales that you will find following this. We also want to thank the Melrose Institute, which is under the umbrella of Park Nicolet. As part of Park Nicolet Health Services, they have a large multi-specialty healthcare organization to treat eating disorders and any complications associated with them. In 2009, the Eating Disorders Institute will move into its new expanded facility with its new name, the Melrose Institute. Please stop by their table at the back of the sanctuary to learn more about their comprehensive programs and their vision for the future after this program. Also this evening, you're going to have a very special opportunity as you leave. Rabbi Kushner's newest book that is not out yet, but is on its way, is entitled Faith and Family. It is a collection of 18 of his sermons created by his congregation as a gift for the over 40 years of service that he has given them as a rabbi. There will be order forms for you at the bookcase tables as you leave. So if you'd like to have a copy of that, you can order it at the table. So that's enough house cleaning for this evening. Have we forgotten anything else? One thing, what would that be? The note cards are in the pews. Thank you, Terry. And the ushers will collect them during the program. I knew that. Okay, note cards are in your pews for questions. Please reach forward, take them out, take out a pencil, write a question, and during the program you can simply lift them up and they'll be picked up for the question. Now, let's get to why we're here. I was speaking with Rabbi Kushner a few minutes ago. This is the fifth time that I've had an opportunity to introduce him to a gathering such as this, and it's always an honor to do so. For those of you who don't know, let me read a small snippet of his biography. Many of you have had the opportunity to read Rabbi Kushner's books or hear his words of hope. He's the best known as the author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, which, of course, is an international bestseller. Harold Kushner is Rabbi Laureate of Temple Israel in Natick, Massachusetts, after serving that congregation for 24 years. In 1995, he was honored by the Christophers, a Roman Catholic organization, as one of 50 people who've made the world a better place in the last 50 years. In 1999, the national organization Religion in American Life honored him as their Clergyman of the Year. He's one of the nation's leading resources for inspiration and hope in times of tragedy and profound pain. He will be speaking to us tonight on his new book, Overcoming Life's Disappointments, and share his wisdom about that with us. Please join me in welcoming Rabbi Harold Kushner.
Good evening. Thank you, Reverend Baggett. And I am so pleased, first of all, to be back in the Twin Cities. It has always been one of my favorite stops when I'm on a nationwide book tour, and I look for opportunities to come back and be reunited with many friends over my previous visits. I'm immensely gratified and very deeply and humbly honored to be invited to speak at this particular venue in the Basilica. I look around at this magnificent building, and all I can think of are the words of Jacob from the book of Genesis. How awesome is this place? Surely the Lord is found here. I won't go on about the part about, and I didn't know it, because I just don't want anybody sending me missionary literature in the morning. Oh, one other introductory note. Apparently, people sitting in the back rows of the auditorium are in a different time zone than people sitting up front. I'm told that the sound system takes several seconds to carry from my mouth to the very last rows. So in the event that I tell a joke and you notice people up front laugh before the people halfway back do, that is the reason. I wrote my most recent book to try and help people answer some important questions. Questions like, how do you heal a broken heart? How do you patch the wounds in a person's soul when life has been harsh? What do you do with all the dreams that don't come true? The book is called Overcoming Life's Disappointments, and when it first came out, the very first interview I ever did, the first question the interviewer asked me was, are there some people who never have any disappointments? My answer was, yes, there are, and I feel sorry for them. Because the person who has never been disappointed in his or her life, I can only imagine is a person who never dared to dream boldly, who never yearned for anything that might not come about. Why? Because he did not trust himself to survive disappointment. He was afraid if he really wanted something and never got it, he wouldn't be able to handle that. And I want to talk to all the people who were brave enough to want something and at one point had to come to terms with the fact that it would not be coming your way. How do you survive that? How do you lose the dream and go on dreaming? I want to focus on three areas where I find people have difficulty. When you're disappointed in yourself, when you're disappointed in other people because they can't give you what you need from them, and when you're disappointed in God and in the way the world runs. First, when you're disappointed in yourself because you have not achieved what you hope to achieve in life. You had a goal when you started out, and somewhere along the way, you had to face the fact that you weren't going to reach it. You had your heart set on a certain job, and it went to somebody else. You were convinced that a certain person was your destined mate, the man, the woman of your dreams, and they went off in another direction. What do you do in a situation like that? My suggestion is you let go of the dream and find another dream to replace it, but never stop dreaming. There is a psychologist, he used to be at Yale University, I think he's retired now, by the name of Daniel Levinson, wrote a book many years ago called The Seasons of a Man's Life. It tries to describe what are the stages a man goes through as he passes from youth to middle age to old age. The book was so good that when I was reading it and I came to the last chapter, I was afraid to finish the book because I said, this is the story of my life and I don't want to find out how it ends. Dr. Levinson has one great line in the book. He says, sometimes the only way you can survive in life, listen closely to this, is to free yourself from the tyranny of the dream. Do you understand what he means by that? If you have a dream of what you would like to achieve, personal, professional, romantic, whatever it might be, and you're afraid you're not going to get it, if you can't let go of the dream, you are condemning yourself to failure. And what I would like to teach you this evening is how to fail and not feel like a failure because of it. That's why my book is based on the life of Moses in the Bible. Because if you only know Moses from Sunday school, if you only know Moses from that dreadful Cecil B. DeMille movie they show every April, if you only know Moses the heroic, that's only half the story and the less useful half. The Moses I meet every Sabbath in our synagogue Torah reading is a Moses who continually confronts disappointment and frustration, falls and picks himself up again, and never stops dreaming. If one dream doesn't come through, he finds another. There are two great disappointments in Moses' life. The first at the beginning of his career as a leader, the second at the very end. First one, he has led the Israelites out of Egyptian slavery, split the Red Sea, brought them to Mount Sinai. There, God speaks to them, and for the first time in human history, God enters into a covenant with a group of people, tells them how he wants them to live. The people say, "Anything you want, God, whatever you ask of us, we will do." Moses goes up Mount Sinai to get some more commandments, has the two tablets of the Ten Commandments personally inscribed by God, starts to carry them down the mountain. Halfway down, he hears noise from ground level, looks down. He sees the Israelites worshiping the golden calf. Days after they promised God they would not worship an idol, they're worshiping an idol. You remember what he does? He is so frustrated and distraught, he takes those tablets of the commandments, throws them to the ground, and shatters them. That's as far as the biblical description goes. When you read that story or heard that story, did you ever wonder what happened to those pieces of the broken tablets? I mean, if you went to the Sinai Desert today, you think you could find them? There are two traditions about what happened. One says, when the people realized what Moses had done, they rushed forward to get these fragments of stones personally inscribed by God. I mean, can you imagine what that would bring on eBay? And the story goes, the rich and powerful people pushed their way to the front of the line, and they grabbed the most desirable pieces, the ones that said, steal, kill, commit adultery. And the poor people were left with the least desirable fragments, the piece that said, thou shalt not. That's one tradition. There's another one I like better. That when Moses realized what had happened, the Bible describes him as going back up the mountain a second time. The first tablets were written by God. The replacement set of Ten Commandments, check out the book of Exodus on this, they were written by Moses at the inspiration of God, and that's crucial. And he carries these replacement sets down, on the way down, picks up the broken fragments of the original commandments, puts both sets in the ark, the broken fragments and the whole replacement set, as a way of remembering the dream he once had that didn't come true, but realizing he has to relinquish it and replace it with something. I have a friend, he's an Orthodox Jew and a psychotherapist, lives in Los Angeles, does a lot of work with Orthodox Jewish families who are having marital problems. When he's dealing with a couple like that, he tells them the story of Moses and the golden calf. And he says to them, do you remember when you were first married, the dream you had that everything would be perfect? The dream you had that your life would be one continuous happy story of making each other happy. That was the expectation of perfection, and human beings are not capable of perfection. Sooner or later, the crack will emerge in your relationship, just like the shattering of the tablets that God wrote for Moses. He would quote Sigmund Freud, who once said, there are four people involved in every marriage. The woman and the man she thinks she married, the man and the woman he thinks he's getting married to. When you find out that the person you married is not the person you thought he was or she was, that is the first crack in the relationship. And then my therapist friend says, what do you do? Can you plaster over that crack? Can you replace that dream of perfection with a reality-based dream that makes room for human frailty, the way Moses did with his second replacement set? If you can, we can repair the relationship. I heard a story once of a young woman, young single woman, out on a blind date with a young pediatrician. Their mothers were friends, been trying to fix them up. They meet, they go out. The evening does not start well. She asks him about his work. He answers in grunts and monosyllables, nothing interesting to say. They sit down to dinner. The first thing he does is spill soup on his necktie. The poor woman is sitting there saying, "My God, is this what the rest of my life is going to be like? Going out with guys who date me because nobody else will go out with them?" And she starts to figure, how long does she have to wait before she can invent a headache and ask to be taken home early where she has a pint of Häagen-Dazs in the freezer? Suddenly, the young pediatrician's cell phone goes off. He answered it. He says to her, "I'm awfully sorry. I've been called to an emergency at the clinic. Would you mind coming along? It won't take very long once I get there, and it's on the way to take you home." At the clinic, watching this young doctor interact with a sick, frightened child, she finds dimensions of sensitivity and humor in him she never knew he had. And to her amazement, she finds herself fantasizing what kind of husband and father this man was capable of being. And she says to herself, "You know, maybe what I need to do to be happy is stop pretending that I'm Bridget Jones, and if I wait long enough, the man of my dreams will come along and revise my dream." It's not a matter of giving up. It's not a matter of settling, "This is the most I deserve." It's a matter of saying, "Because of my life experiences, I can see qualities in this young man that other women don't even notice. And because of what he's been through in his life, maybe he can find qualities in me that other people don't appreciate, and maybe we can really be happy together and make each other happy." When you're disappointed in yourself because your dream didn't come true, because the one thing you had your heart set on is irretrievably out of reach, what you have to do then is free yourself from the tyranny of the dream. Let go of it, because all that dream is doing to you now is telling you that you're a failure and you don't need to hear that message. But never give up dreaming. Find another, more realistic dream. Find a dream that makes room for human frailty and human imperfection, and let that be your goal and your vision instead. That's the first step. How do you let go of your disappointment in yourself? But what if it is other people who have let you down? How can you come to terms with the way other people have disappointed you? I found the answer to that in what is probably the least promising chapter of the entire Torah, of the five books of Moses. It's in the exact middle of the book of Leviticus, chapter 13. I'll tell you exactly where it is. It's a section that deals with leprosy. You know where it is? When you were a teenager and you sat down to read the Bible cover to cover, this is where you gave up. The condition the book of Leviticus describes, it's translated as leprosy. It's not what doctors today know as leprosy, is what is known as Hansen's disease. What it is, it's a highly disfiguring, dreadfully contagious, but not really serious skin condition. It is so contagious that if you get it, you have to be quarantined, sent out of the camp. Nobody can visit you, not your family, not your friends, nobody. And then we read twice a week the Kohen, the village priest who is also the village medical authority. And when I speak to doctors' groups, which I do frequently, I remind them that thousands of years ago, their profession and mine were combined in the same person. The religious authority was the medical authority. The Kohen would come by and see how this poor guy is getting along. And according to the book of Leviticus, he would examine the skin lesions. If they go deep into the flesh, the man is still contagious and has to remain in quarantine. If they're only superficial, then he's sufficiently healed, he can go back home. Now, because the Kohen has to evaluate how deep into the flesh the lesion goes, the rule is evolved. A Kohen who is blind in one eye is disqualified from examining lepers. Why? Because he cannot see in depth. That's what you have two eyes for, binocular vision, so you can see things in depth. I read that, and I had this great insight. Not about leprosy, I mean, we will ever need that. This is the key to dealing with people who disappoint you. Don't only see them with one eye as they are at this moment. See them with both eyes. See them in depth. Let me tell you the most remarkable thing that happened to me recently, a year and a half ago, March of 2006. I was invited to speak at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida. The first thing that happened is that week they had just made the Final Four of the National Basketball Championship. The assistant coach of the basketball team, who's Jewish, gave me a tour of the facilities, and as I was leaving, he said, "Rabbi, you know, we got a big game against Georgetown tomorrow. Would you say a prayer for the team?" So I improvised the prayer. When they beat Georgetown, and then when they beat UCLA to win the championship, he called me and thanked me for my help. What I learned from that experience is that prayer works. And that prayer works better if you have Joachim Noah, Al Horford, and Corey Brewer playing for you. That wasn't the amazing part. The amazing part happened later that evening. They had a little reception for me before my lecture. At the reception, a man comes up to me, tall, thin, I would guess early 60s, walks with a cane, hands me his card, and says, "Rabbi, do you remember me?" Now, we rabbis go through this all the time. "You don't remember me? I met you 12 years ago at my nephew's bar mitzvah." So I give him my standard answer, you know, "Gee, the name is familiar. Tell me where I know you from." And he says to me, "In 1957, you were my counselor in summer camp." And then it all came back. When he was my camper, he was the most obnoxious 16-year-old I have ever dealt with. Oversexed and undermining my authority and foul-mouthed and trying to get other people in trouble. And if I think back on the summer of 1957, and I don't do it often, largely because of this guy, but if I do think back on it, my lingering regret is that I didn't crack down on him, embarrass him in front of his friends, humiliate him, kick him out of camp, send him home. I wish I'd been tougher with him, and I'm not looking forward to this guy coming back into my life. But he's there, and he starts to tell me what happened to him since that summer. He finished high school. He went to college. He went to medical school. He joined the Army Medical Corps, served with distinction at Walter Reed Medical Center in Washington, rose to the rank of full colonel, and was being considered for brigadier general when he had a stroke. That's why he walks with a cane. Had to resign from the service and began a second career rehabilitating stroke patients based on his own experience. He tells me he's remained a traditional Jew all those years. He speaks to me in fluent Hebrew. He recites by memory the prayer he recited when he came out of his coma after the stroke, thanking God for restoring his soul to him. And then, this is the shocking part, then he says, "Rabbi Kushner, I'm so glad I had this chance to meet you again so I could thank you. If you had not been so patient with me when I was an obnoxious 16-year-old, I never would have had the confidence to do the things I've done." And I realized, for almost 50 years, I have been sinning against this young man. I have been holding on to an obsolete memory. I betrayed the mandate of the Torah to see people binocularly with both eyes. I only remembered him what he was like when he was 16. And face it, what were any of us like when we were 16? Would we want to be remembered for that image? And this becomes the key. How does Moses put up with these people who drive him crazy? Because he doesn't only see them dancing around the golden calf. He remembers where they were last month. They were slaves. Their whole lives they've been slaves. This is their first experience of making decisions for themselves. and because he sees the future and has a vision of what sort of community they might become if they could do it right. This is binocular vision. So when a woman in my congregation comes to me terribly upset because she's found out her husband's been having an extramarital affair, and she says to me, "My friends all say I should throw the bum out, and I probably should, but you know, there's a part of me that still loves him, and I don't know what to do. My problem is, every time I look at him, all I can see is him in the arms of that other woman when I thought he was working late to support the family." I say to her, "That's all you can see. How does that make you feel?" She says, "It makes me feel pretty lousy." I say, "Well, if that's all you can see and makes you feel lousy, why don't you change the channel? Why don't you try and see something else? Can you picture your husband as a loving and devoted father? Can you picture him as a man who brings his paycheck home regularly every week? Can you picture him the way you once did when you fell in love? Can you picture him as a man who is genuinely remorseful and is pleading for a second chance to show he's learned from his experience? Because if you can see that, if you can not only see that one image of him at his worst, but if you can see what he had been and what he might be, maybe we can save this relationship." I was in New York one day on business, and I had lunch at one of these chic New York restaurants on Madison Avenue. The tables are so close together that you can't help participating in the conversation next to you. At the table next to me, there are four women, friends, having lunch, and I can't help hearing what they're talking about. They are going around the table seriatim, complaining about their husbands. Everyone takes a turn talking about what her husband does that drives her crazy. And when they finish dinner and they pay the bill and they get up to leave, I realize these four women have taught me a couple of very important lessons. First, if any of those women were married to a husband who was perfect, it would ruin her life. Really, she would have nothing to bring to the conversation. Her best friends would hate her. They'd stop having lunch with her. She'd have no social life at all. I hope she appreciates what a favor her husband is doing her. And the second thing they taught me was, these women have just spent 12:30 till 1:30 complaining nonstop about their husbands. What are they going to do next? They're going to go home. They're going to welcome their husbands. They're going to have dinner with their husbands. They're going to share their beds with these husbands they've been complaining about. What went on at lunch is not how they saw their husbands. It was a very small sliver of how they saw their husbands. They had learned how to see them binocularly, to see them in depth, and they could handle the disappointments in that context. I don't know if you noticed something a couple of years ago. All of a sudden, there was an epidemic of movies about people losing their memory. Do you remember any of them? There was an Alan Sandler comedy, 51st Dates, I think it was called. His girlfriend meets him every day and can't remember ever having seen him before. There was a mystery story about a man who's brutally attacked, can't remember any of the details, and has to retrace his life to find out what happened to him and why. There were these science fiction stories about people who know too much and have their memories erased. One of them really stuck with me. Don't know how many of you saw it. If you hadn't seen it and you were planning to rent it this weekend, I apologize. I'm going to spoil it for you. It was called Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Ring a bell for any of you? It's a story of a young man and a young woman who meet, are attracted to each other, have a torrid, passionate affair, and then mostly because the woman is so volatile, the affair breaks up. They find their breakup so unbearably painful that they agree to go through this experimental psychiatric procedure. The thesis of the movie is there's a psychiatrist who has learned how to pinpoint the precise location of a specific memory in your brain and erase it electronically. 3 years ago when the movie came out, this was science fiction. Since then, they've really learned how to do that. Did you know that? They don't know how to erase it, but scientists can trigger a memory and notice where in the brain the synapses light up. But in the movie, he knows how to zap them. So they have to tell him everything they remember about each other. First, the young woman undergoes the procedure, meets the guy in can't imagine she ever met him before. He undergoes, it's his turn now. Halfway through the erasure process, the man summons up a memory to be eliminated, a time when he and his girlfriend were in the park, and he's saying to her, you know, this is the happiest moment I ever remember in my life. And suddenly, he realizes he's saying to himself, wait a minute. If this is the happiest he's ever been in his life, why is he trying to erase the memory? And he starts to fight against the experiment. And the idea that attracted me so much about the movie is our memories of good times are inextricably mixed in with memories of sad times. People you loved and lost through death or through their leaving you. Things you enjoyed and they were taken from you. Things you used to be good at and you can no longer do. So many of our sad memories are inextricably bound up with happy ones. And if you want to have the sad memories erased, you're going to lose the happy ones as well. A couple of years ago, there was a beloved Israeli songwriter by the name of Naomi Shemer who died. I think of her as the Irving Berlin of Israel, because just as you cannot imagine the United States without Irving Berlin, without God Bless America, without White Christmas, you can't picture Israel without the popular songs of Naomi Shemer. Her last great hit was called For the Honey and the Sting. The title is taken from an incident in the Talmud. A man is walking through the fields. He's hungry. He sees a beehive. He sticks his hand into the beehive to get the honeycomb, and the bees sting him. He walks away muttering, I can do without the honey and without the bee stings. Naomi Shemer says, no. No, I want them both. I want to experience life in the fullness. I want to know the joy of love and the heartbreak of love when it ends. I want to know the exhilaration of yearning and the disappointment, the crushing disappointment of having your dreams fall dead at your feet. I want the honey and I want the sting. I want to risk myself, make myself vulnerable by loving, even though I know it means I will be hurt in the end. And this, it seems to me, is the authentically human reaction. To be a complete human being, you have to dream and you have to be prepared to be hurt. You have to make yourself vulnerable and you have to have enough confidence in yourself that you will survive when your vulnerability leads you to being attacked. The honey and the sting, the pain and the pleasure, the sweet and the bitter memories. Will people disappoint you? I guarantee it. People are imperfect. People are frail. If God could only love perfect people, he would be a very lonely God. And if we could only love perfect human beings in our family, in our world, we will end up lonely as well. We need to learn the skill of Moses to see people binocularly, to see the terrible thing they did yesterday in the context of the wonderful thing they did a month ago and the things they might do a month hence. The third, maybe the most interesting aspect of what I'm going to say to you tonight. Maybe the greatest lesson that Moses teaches me is at the very end of his life. If the first crushing disappointment of Moses is when the Israelites, days after they accept the Ten Commandments, are worshiping the golden calf, the final disappointment comes when God says to him, all those people who have made your life miserable for 40 years, they will get to live in the promised land, and you never will. You won't see it. Moses, as much as any character in the Bible, has the right to feel that God has cheated him, that life has cheated him, and he is strong enough to get over that sense of resentment. And that's why he becomes a role model for all the people I know who could not enjoy the last third of their lives because they felt that life had cheated them. They did not have what they deserved. They didn't have the career they deserved. They didn't have the wealth they deserved. Their health didn't last. Someone they loved was taken away from them too soon. Whatever the circumstance, they have a grievance against God because God didn't give them what they deserved. What do you do in a case like that? First thing you do is I give people permission to get angry at God. Life has been unfair. Life has hurt you. Go. You know, what are you going to do? Don't yell at your relatives. Don't take it out on your family. Be angry at God. You're not going to hurt God. The good news is God is not up for re-election this year. Get as angry as you want, and when you've got the anger out of your system, don't let it be a barrier between you and everything that God represents. Let me show you something absolutely fascinating. In the opening chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, the last of the five books of Moses, Moses complains about the way God has treated him. He has never done this before. This is so completely out of character from Moses to complain about God. Why does he do it? One brilliant Israeli scholar gave me the answer. She said, he is giving the Israelites permission to vent their anger at God. And they do. Right away, they say, God must hate us, which we who have read Sigmund Freud understand to mean we hate God, right? They're projecting their feelings onto God. God must hate us. If God loved us, he would have let us stay in Egypt and send the Egyptians out into this miserable desert. If God really loved us, he would have told us to turn right at Mount Sinai and go to Kuwait instead of turning left and going to Canaan. After Moses vents his anger at God, after the Israelites accept his invitation to vent their anger at God, immediately after that, you get the most famous line in the entire book of Deuteronomy. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Jews know that from Shema Yisrael. Christians know it because Jesus called it the greatest of all the commandments. What you may not have realized, that is the first time the Bible talks about loving God. First time. Up until that point, it talks about fearing God, obeying God, heeding God, revering God, but not loving. You know why? Because if you cannot acknowledge your anger, you cannot love. The wife who is afraid to tell her husband that sometimes he really ticks her off will not be able genuinely to love him because she has made their relationship inauthentic. She is censoring her feelings, and she cannot love spontaneously. The husband who is afraid to criticize his wife because he just wants harmony at home, that's going to be an impediment to his loving her. And people who feel they cannot admit that they're angry at God because of the way life has turned out will not be able to fulfill the commandment, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. So acknowledge the anger, get it out of your system, work it through, and then get on with an honest relationship with God. I read a really good book when I was preparing to write Overcoming Life's Disappointments. It's the final volume of a longitudinal study done by Harvard University on what makes for a happy life. The book is called Aging Well, and it says there are three things you need to do to enjoy the last third of your life. Because so many people I have known cannot enjoy the last part of their lives. They are so bitter about what life did not give them. Number one, keep expanding your social circle. As you lose friends to death or to migration, find new friends so that you feel your world is expanding and not shrinking. Number two, develop a capacity for gratitude. A grateful person cannot be bitter. A grateful person cannot be angry. Gratitude, I will insist, is the fundamental religious dimension. It is the only religious response I can demand from a person who is not religious. It's not a question of faith. It's not a question of theology. It's not a question of belief. It's simply a recognition that stop kvetching to me about all the things life didn't give you and look at what life has given you. In my earlier book on the 23rd Psalm, I use this analogy when I write about my cup runneth over. Can you picture the scene? Somebody you know is having a birthday party, and you carefully choose a present for him, very thoughtfully. You wrap it, you give it to him. He unwraps it, looks at it, and says, you know, I really wanted something nicer from you. How do you feel at that moment? You want to take the president and hit him over the head with it. You want to strangle the guy. May I point out that this is what we do to God. God gives us life and health and parents and skills and family. And instead of saying thank you, we say, I wish I were better looking. I wish I were taller. I wish I were more talented. Instead of accepting the gifts, we complain about what we didn't get. Develop a capacity for gratitude. And did you notice in the 23rd Psalm, that line about my cup runneth over, that line about overflowing with gratitude, comes after he has been in the valley of the shadow of death. When his life has been smooth and perfect, it never occurs to him to say thank you. It's only after he's had the experience of realizing how tenuous and how fragile all these gifts are, only then does he say, my cup runneth over. So attribute number two is gratitude. And attribute number three is the key to the whole game. Cleanse your soul of all those long-standing grudges and resentments. Forgiveness. All those resentments are doing, they're poisoning you. They're not hurting anybody else, certainly not the person you're angry at. Somebody once described bearing a grudge as swallowing poison, hoping it'll make the guy next door sick. I gave a Yom Kippur sermon once on the question of forgiveness. Reverend Baggett referred to this book of my sermons, which is coming out November 1st, that you can get from the bookcase in Wayzata. As of November 1st, thereabouts, you can sign up for it later, but that's a word from our sponsor. 2 days later, a member of my woman of the congregation comes in to complain to me, very upset with me about that sermon. She tells me how 10 years ago her husband walked out on her and the kids, ran off with a woman he'd been seeing on the side. She says, for 10 years, I've had to hold two jobs to pay the bills. For 10 years, I've had to be father and mother to these kids. And you want me to forgive that guy for what he did to us? I said, yeah, I want you to forgive him. Not to excuse him, not to say it was okay, you understand, it wasn't so terrible, people do these things. I want you to forgive him as a way of saying he has no right to live inside your head any more than he has a right to live inside your house. If this guy was so bad to you, why are you giving him the power to turn you into a bitter, resentful woman? That is not you. And why are you letting him do that to you? Forgiveness doesn't mean saying what he did was okay. Forgiveness means saying, what you did was so vile and unacceptable, I'm not going to rent you space in my head anymore. Best story I ever heard on the importance of forgiveness as a favor you do yourself, not a favor you do the other person who probably doesn't deserve it. A friend of mine, when she was a young mother, was sitting in the park watching the kids play. She sees two little boys in a sandbox get into an argument. One says, I hate you, you're not my friend anymore. I am never playing with you again for the rest of my life. And for 5 minutes, they play on opposite ends of the sandbox, and then slowly, warily, they start to edge closer to each other until a few minutes later, they're playing happily again. My friend turns to a young mother on the bench next to her, and she says, how do kids do that? How can they be so upset with each other 1 minute and the best of friends the next? And the other woman says something wonderfully wise. She says, it's easy. They choose happiness over righteousness. It is so seductive. It is so tempting to hold on to righteousness. It feels so good to be the victim, to be the aggrieved party, to own the moral high ground that we don't notice we are making ourselves bitter in the process. We are draining the joy from our lives. I will not ask for a show of hands, but if you people here are in any way representative of the people I've served in Massachusetts, I would guess in 3/4 of the families representing here, there is somebody who's not talking to another member of the family. That sound at all familiar? Sometimes they don't even remember how it started. Was it about a loan that wasn't repaid or a loan that was, or was it somebody not invited to somebody's wedding? I don't know. All we know is we don't talk to them. And who do you think you're hurting? by filling your last years with bitterness, with anger, sometimes anger against people who died long ago. I have said to people, you know, your parents have been dead for 30 years and you're still feuding with them. Let go of it already. Because you're the only person you're hurting is yourself. I was talking about my book just about a year ago, almost to the day. I was in San Francisco. During the coffee hour after the lecture there, it was a much smaller crowd, so they could afford to spring for coffee and cake that night. Young woman comes up to me, tells me the following story. 10 years ago, she was a graduate student at one of the local universities. She applied for a very prestigious fellowship. Had she gotten it, it would have given her career a tremendous jump start. Her advisor was on sabbatical, so she went to another one of her professors, asked him to write a recommendation to the committee for her. He said he would be pleased to write a very strong recommendation in exchange for sexual favors. She said, "I'm sorry, I don't do that." He said, "I understand perfectly. No hard feelings, good luck." And he wrote a letter to the committee saying he found her unqualified. 10 years later, she is still angry at him. 10 years later, she says to me, "What can I do to get back at him?" I say, "Nothing." "Nothing?" I said, "No. Look, you've been angry at him for 10 years. Has it hurt him? If he has given you a thought at all, it probably pleases him that he has the power to upset you so much. Stop trying to please him. He doesn't deserve it." She said, "You mean he got away with it? He won and I lost?" I said, "No, he lost and you won. You know why? Because you preserved your integrity and he compromised his. And any time you sell your integrity out, whatever you get for it, you've gotten a bad bargain. You will be the winner if you can take away from him the power to make you angry and upset and resentful. People who hurt us don't deserve that kind of power over us. Forgive them, not for their sakes, for yours." Viktor Frankl, who wrote that marvelous book, Man's Search for Meaning, about his experiences in Auschwitz, taught me one of the most enduring truths I've ever learned. You cannot control what other people do. You can always control how you respond to what other people do. And that is the freedom we have to exercise. And the freedom to let go of anger and resentment is one of the most important freedoms we will ever exercise. I think of Moses at the end of his life, climbing the mountain on the last page of the book of Deuteronomy. This man who has climbed so many mountains in his career, climbing one last mountain, and when he gets to the top, he'll die. And I find myself wondering what is going through Moses' mind at that moment. What is he remembering? Is he remembering the golden calf? Is he remembering the shattering of the commandments? Is he remembering the day God told him he would not enter the promised land? Or is he remembering the day he took a band of slaves and set them free and brought them to know the will of God and taught them how God wants people to live? I would like to think that Moses looks back on all those years and he remembers the honey and the sting, remembers the bitter and the sweet. He remembers the dreams that came true and the dreams that would never come true. And I would like to think, looking back, he realizes he's experienced life in all of its fullness, because life in its fullness will always be a mixture of achievement and frustration, of success and failure, of good news and bad news, of honey and of stings. He looks back on the wholeness of life and he realizes how richly he has lived. Thank you all very much.
You can pass your questions in, and the ushers will bring them up to me. Thanks. Rabbi, our world has become so complex, so has parenting. What are the top values or behaviors parents need to model and encourage?
As the world has become increasingly complex, so has parenting. What are the values that parents need to communicate to their children? You know the story of the minister, young man, came to a new church, and the first Sunday he's there, his sermon was 10 Commandments for Effective Parenting. 10 years later, he'd gotten married, he had children, and now he gave a sermon on suggestions for being a good parent. 5 years after that, his kids had grown up, and he advertised a sermon, How to Survive Your Children's Adolescence. There are a couple of things I have learned, and like everything else I've shared with you tonight, I've learned from my mistakes as much as from anything else. The first, I think you will be able to appreciate. Children may not be listening to you, but they're watching you. And they may not model themselves after what you tell them to do. They will model themselves after what they see you doing. You will always, always be their primary role models. Now, for some of us, that is a terrifying thought. You have to tell your children what you care about, what your values are, and then you have to do the single most difficult task of being a parent, and that is to acknowledge that your children do not belong to you. They belong to themselves and they belong to the future. You can give them your hopes and your dreams, but you can't pull their strings. You can't make them do anything. Because if you do, what you're doing is telling every generation they have to live by proxy. I want you to do what I want, and when you become a parent, you can make your kids do what they want, and when your kids become parents, they can make their children do what they want, and so on till the end of time. That's crazy. People own their own lives. You can care about them. You can support them. There is a famous story about the man who comes to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, we've always kept a very pious home. We've raised our children to be religious. And our son, when he grew up, just went against everything we taught him and everything we stand for. He does things which hurt us so badly. What should I do? And the rabbi gives him three words for an answer. And the three words are, love him more. Being a parent is not a conditional sort of thing. It's an obligation of what you owe children. And what do they owe you in return is to be a good parent to their own children. There's a famous medieval story, kind of a silly story, but I like it. A mother hen was walking her chicks down the road when they come to a large puddle, and the chicks are too small to cross the puddle. There are three of them. So the mother hen says to the first one, if I pick you up and carry you across the puddle, what will you do for me? And the chick says, I'll carry you across the next puddle. The mother hen says, that's ridiculous. You can't carry me across a puddle. If you could, we wouldn't have a situation here. She says to the second one, if I pick you up and carry you across the puddle, what will you do for me? And he says, when I grow up, I'll carry you across puddles. And the mother hen says, no, that's ridiculous. When you grow up, if I'm still alive, I'll still be able to cross puddles by myself. Turns to the third one and says, if I were to carry you across this puddle, what will you do for me in return? And the third chick says, when I become a mother hen, I'll carry my babies across puddles. And that, of course, is the right answer. What we teach our children to do is not to obey us, but to be as good a parent to our grandchildren as we are to them. Will they disappoint us? Guaranteed. Absolutely 100% guaranteed, one way or another. In their grades, in their athletic achievements, in their choice of a career, one way or another, they will disappoint us. And all we can do at that point is do what the rabbi said to his congregant, love them more.
Someone heard you speak to a woman on the radio this morning, and you counseling her to forgive past hurts so she could reconnect with her family. What if they are not past hurts, but ongoing ones? How do you love people who don't treat you as you'd like?
How do you love people who continue to treat you badly? Very simple. You love them at a distance. You love them and you make allowances for it if they are toxic. For example, my mantra when people come to me because of marital problems, when one partner comes and says that he or she isn't sure they want to stay in the marriage, my advice is always pay the therapist before you pay the lawyer. Give the marriage every chance to succeed, because if you don't, how do you know you're not going to replicate the same problems the second time around? The only exception to that, the only case in which I will tell somebody, get out of the marriage, is where there is physical abuse. You have no obligation to put up with physical abuse. That is always, always wrong and unacceptable. If people are cruel, if people talk about you, if people prefer a sibling to you, all you can do is, you know, recognize that they have this shortcoming and love them anyway. Woman came up to me and she tells me that they just heard that her father has advanced form of cancer and is only a few weeks to live. And I suspect that the conversation will be about how do we go about with the funeral and how do we observe the memorial week and ritual questions like that. That's not what she says. She says, I hate my father. He was never a father to me. He walked out on the family when I was 5 years old and never did anything for us. Why should I have to mourn for him? I was stumped for a moment. Then I said, you grieve for two reasons. First, if you don't, someplace down the road, you will have this undigested lump of grief in your heart because you did it wrong. And the second reason is you won't be grieving for your father, the man who died. You'll be grieving for the father you always wanted to have and never did, and now it's too late ever to have one. Grieve for the parent you wanted and couldn't have. When the parents, siblings, whoever it is, who are making your life miserable are there, keep your distance, but don't respond in I am constantly telling people, you're feuding with a member of the family, invite them to the wedding. You be the one who keeps the door open and let them slam it. Don't you be the one who slams doors. You never know how things might turn out. Yes, it is a tragic and a painful thing, and you wish it were otherwise, but sometimes it won't be otherwise. All you can do is you be the honorable person. Don't descend to their level.
Survival and acceptance is understandable to life's disappointments. However, what are we to do when facing evil, intolerance, and enemies? Example, terrorists who want to kill us.
The terrorist who wants to kill us, you certainly don't invite him to go ahead and You have to distance yourself from evil. It is generally a mistake. You remember the story of Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby? The more you entangle yourself in evil, because you think maybe you can pull a person out of it, the harder it will be to keep yourself clean. But there's, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly how the story goes. I think it was a couple of people in New York City having lunch one day, and they say, who do you think are the three most evil people in the world in human history? And they each make their lists and they compare notes, and it turns out that they've all listed the same three names: Hitler, Stalin, and George Steinbrenner. Fact is, there are evil people, there are psychopaths. The good news is they are relatively rare. I remember one of the cleverest things I ever found. It was in a souvenir shop in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a little button that said, never attribute to malice what is explicable by stupidity. That is, a lot of people do dumb, harmful things, not because they're malicious, but because they're dumb. And, you know, being dumb is an acceptable alternative. You just have to learn to cope with it. Most people who mess your lives up are just inept, awkward, selfish, short-sighted, not necessarily evil. Evil is rare, and keep your distance from it. Human frailty is all too common and very hard to avoid.
Rabbi, many of your perspectives and your wisdom seem so much like that of Jesus Christ. Agreed? Comments?
Well, he was Jewish. Bob, you will remember the answer I gave to a question about Jesus in Vero Beach when
I spoke. May I ask it?
By all means.
So, Rabbi, right here, was Jesus Christ really the Son of God?
You realize what an auspicious occasion this is for me to answer that in this setting. Now, Bob, I'll tell you what I believe about Jesus. I believe Jesus was God's instrument for bringing the morality of the Hebrew Scriptures to the rest of the human race. Had it not been for the activities of Jesus and Paul and the disciples, all the wisdom of the Bible, the prophets, the Psalms, the commandments, would have remained the patrimony of a tiny sliver of humanity instead of being shared with all of humanity all over the globe. I think that humanity everywhere has to be, whatever your theological perception of Jesus, we have to be grateful for the work he did in bringing the Word of God to so many people.
What do you say to your 18-year-old daughter who states that God has never answered even one of her prayers?
What do I say to the 18-year-old who says God has never even answered one of her prayers? I'll tell you what I do not say. I do not say what some of our colleagues say, namely, God always answers prayers, but sometimes the answer is no. Get used to it. I don't want to tell people that God had the power to answer your prayer and stubbornly chose not to. I don't want somebody to believe that God could have saved your mother during surgery and chose to let her die. You know what the problem is, Bob, and whoever asked the question? We have a problem understanding prayer in this country because we have confused God with Santa Claus. We think prayer means making a list of everything you want and don't have and convincing God you've been a good girl or boy and you deserve it. Now, forgive me, that is not God. That's Santa Claus. Tell you a true story. A friend of mine, a rabbi in Southern California, shared this with me. One Sunday, he was scheduled to officiate at the wedding of the daughter of the president of his congregation. It was to take place in the sumptuous backyard of the president's palatial home, weather permitting. If it rained, they'd have to cram everybody into the house, and the house really wasn't big enough, so they were hoping for good weather. Sunday morning, the forecast is cloudy, 60% chance of rain. 10 o'clock, the wedding is scheduled for noon. 10 o'clock, clouds, dark clouds threaten. The mother of the bride gives her husband a $20 bill, says, put this in a charity box for good weather. 11 o'clock, rumble of thunder in the distance, darker clouds than before. Mother of the bride gives her husband a $50 bill, put it in the charity box for good weather. Noon, the wedding goes off without a hitch, dry, balmy, beautiful. That woman will believe that her prayer was answered because she gave to charity, and she will continue to believe it until the day someone she loves is in the hospital and she gives $1,000 to the charity and he dies anyway, and she won't be able to understand why God changed the rules on her. There was an experiment done about a year ago under the auspices of the Harvard Medical School. Did you read about it? On whether praying for people helps them get better. Carefully matched groups, some were prayed for, some were not prayed for. Turns out it made no difference. CNN interviewed me about that. I said, I think it's the nicest thing anybody's done for God in decades. Now people have no reason to be angry at God if they pray for somebody's health and they don't recover, because that's not God's job. It is not God's job to make sick people healthy. That's a doctor's job. It's God's job to make sick people brave, and that God does. 18-year-old, I can guess what she prayed for. There are times when, let me put it this way. If there are any country music fans in the cathedral tonight, you know the Garth Brooks song, Unanswered Prayers? Favorite song of mine. Story of a man in his early 40s who's at a communal event, sees a woman who looks vaguely familiar, can't quite place her. Then he realizes this is the girl he had a crush on when he was in seventh grade. And every night when he went to bed, he would pray to God to make her love him the way he loved her, and he could not understand why God would not answer the prayers of this devout 13-year-old boy. 30 years later, seeing who he's grown up to be, seeing who she's grown up to be, he comes to the conclusion some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers. I like the song, I don't like the theology, but that's okay. I have a deal with Garth Brooks. I don't do country music and he doesn't do theology. The real answer, I think, is something I learned from Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher and theologian, who said, you don't pray to God for things, you pray to God for God. You don't ask God for anything except God's presence. Real prayer is not asking, it's not begging. This is interesting. In every European language, there is an etymological connection between the verb to pray and the verb to beg. In Spanish, in German, in English, precarious means as uncertain as prayer. And so we've made this connection in our minds that praying is begging. It's not. Praying is thanking. Praying is inviting God into your life. Because like the hospital patient, when you invite God into your life, nothing is as scary or as unbearable as it would be if you had to face it alone. If I may hypothesize that this adolescent girl was praying for boyfriends, running the risk that she will end up not only questioning God's benevolence, but questioning God's taste, what I would say to her is, you don't ask God for boyfriends. That's not where you get one. You ask God to give you a sense of confidence in yourself. You ask God for the ability to feel good about yourself. And if God does that for you, you will be surprised how many boyfriends you can pick up along the way. Bob, if you got one or two good ones left, then I think we'll let the people
go.
We
have two left that I'd like to do. I've got about 50 here, but only two. How does one come to terms with the Holocaust?
How does one come to terms with the Holocaust? Best answer I ever heard is Elie Wiesel's, who once heard in a lecture I attended, I once heard him say, I will not deign to explain the Holocaust, because to explain it is to make it acceptable within the bounds of human activity, and it's beyond the bounds. For me, the Holocaust is not a theological issue. How could God let such a thing happen? For me, it's a psychological issue. How could human beings have been so cruel to each other? My answer is the answer I found in a book by a German theologian, a woman named Dorothy Zola, who writes, where was God in Auschwitz? God was at the side of the victims, comforting them and suffering with them, not on the side of the murderers. And she goes on to say, to suggest by word or hint that what the Nazis did to innocent victims could possibly have been the will of God is to offer us a God so cruel, so heartless, that no decent person should ever worship him again. I believe the Holocaust was the result of human beings misusing their human freedom to do incomparable evil, and I must believe that it broke God's heart as readily as it breaks the heart of people like you and me.
Last question.
Last one.
Why do bad things happen to good people?
You probably expect me to say I wrote a book on the subject, except that I didn't. I never wrote a book by that name. I don't mean somebody else wrote it. I mean, the book I wrote is called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. That's not a quibble. That happens to be the point of the book. I don't want to bother trying to understand why. Why is a pointless question. First, because too often asking why becomes a search for blame. Whose fault was it? Who was supposed to be watching her? Who told her she could take the car? Which side of the family did the faulty gene come down on? And what do you achieve when you've been hurt by life by finding somebody to blame? And secondly, why is pointless? Because why focuses on the past? And as you may have discovered in your own lives, no matter how smart you are and no matter how pious you are, you can't change the past. But the main reason why I don't want to ask why is, why me is not a question. That's a very important insight. Why did this happen to me is not a question, it is a cry of pain. And the person who says, why me, doesn't really want an answer. She is looking for consolation rather than explanation. At some level, you intuitively understand this. Look, your best friend says to you, what did I ever do to deserve this? And she really doesn't want you to tell her all the things she did to deserve this. She wants you to hold her hand and convince her that she's a good person and she doesn't deserve this. And the only answer to the person who says, why did God let this happen to me, is to keep your mouth shut and hug her, because that's what she's really asking for, consolation, not explanation. There is a place for theology. It is not a time for theology when your loved one is bleeding in front of you. The real answer is not why do these things happen, but where do we find the resources to cope with them? And to use the words of the psalmist as a closing benediction, you remember he asks, I lift mine eyes to the hills, from where does my help come? He doesn't say, from where does my tumor come? He doesn't say, from where does my injury come? He doesn't say, from where does my heart condition come? It doesn't matter where they come from, they're there, he's got to deal with them. He asks, from where does my help come? And our answer, it seems to me, must be the psalmist's answer as well. You remember what he says next, my help comes from the Lord, maker of heaven and earth. Thank you and bless you all.
He will be signing them for you. You can also get a copy of his newest book. Thank you for being here. Good night.